If I wanted to see folks from some other planet, I'd rent me a video. You heard anything new? On the radio, they're saying it's all a false alarm, he replied, zipping his jacket. He looked at the windows between the restaurant and the parking lot, verifying what he had already seen. With the combination of frost on the glass and the snow outside, the view was nil. No one in here was going to see what he drove away in. Yeah? Really? Relief made her look less tired. Younger. Yeah. Don't be looking for your friend too soon, darling. He said he had to lay a serious loaf. A frown creased the skin between her eyebrows. He said that? Good night. Happy Thanksgiving. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Some of that, Jonesy hoped, was him, trying to get through, to be noticed. Before he could see if it was noticed, the view before his office window revolved as Mr. Gray turned him away from the cash register. 5 minutes later, he was heading south on the turnpike again, the chains on the trooper's cruiser thrupping and zinging, allowing him to maintain a steady 40 miles an hour. Jonesy felt Mr. Gray reaching out, reaching back. Mr. Gray could touch Henry's mind but not get inside it. Like Jonesy, Henry was to some degree different. No matter. There was a man with Henry, overhill or underhill. From him, Mr. Gray was able to get a good fix. They were 70 miles behind, maybe more. And pulling off the turnpike? Yes, pulling off in Derry. Mr. Gray cast back farther yet and discovered more pursuers, three of them. But Jonesy felt this group's main focus was not Mr. Gray, but overhill, underhill. He found that both incredible and inexplicable, but it seemed to be true. And Mr. Gray liked that just fine. He didn't even bother to look for the reason why overhill, underhill, and Henry might be stopping. Mr. Gray's main concern was switching to another vehicle, a snowplow, if Jonesy's driving skills would allow him to operate it. It would mean another murder, but that was all right with the increasingly human Mr. Gray. Mr. Gray was just getting warmed up. Owen Underhill is standing on the slope very near to the pipe which juts out of the foliage, and he sees them help the muddy, wild-eyed girl, Josie, out of the pipe. He sees Duddits, a large young man with shoulders like a football player and the improbable blonde hair of a movie idol, sweep her into a hug, kissing her dirty face in big smacks. He hears her first words. "I want to see my mommy!" It's good enough for the boys. There's no call to the police, no call for an ambulance. They simply help her up the slope, through the break in the board fence, across Strawford Park. The girls in yellow have been replaced by girls in green. Neither they nor their coach pay any attention to the boys or their filthy, draggle-haired prize. And then down Kansas Street to Maple Lane. They know where Josie's mommy is, her daddy too. Not just the Rinkenhauers either. When the boys get back, there are cars parked the length of the block on both sides of the Cavell house. Roberta was the one who proposed calling the parents of Josie's friends and classmates. They will search on their own, and they will paper the town with the missing posters, she says. Not in shadowy, out-of-the-way places, which is where missing children posters in Derry tend to wind up, either, but where people must see them. Roberta's enthusiasm is enough to light some faint hope in the eyes of Ellen and Hector Rinkenhauer. The other parents respond, too. It is as if they have just been waiting to be asked. The calls started shortly after Duddits and his friends trooped out the door. To play, Roberta assumed, and someplace close by because Henry's old jalopy is still parked in the driveway. And by the time the boys return, there are almost 24 people crammed into the Cavell's living room, drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. The man currently addressing them is a guy Henry has seen before, a lawyer named Dave Bocklin. His son, Kendall, sometimes plays with Duddits. Ken Bocklin also has downs, and he's a good enough guy, but he's not like Duds. Get serious, though, who is? The boys stand at the entrance to the living room, Josie among them. She is once more carrying her great big purse with Barbie Ken tucked away inside. Even her face is almost clean, because Beaver, seeing all the cars, has done a little work on it with his handkerchief out in the driveway. Tell you what, it made me feel funny, the beeve confides later after all the hoop-de-do and fuckery has died down. Here, I'm cleaning up this girl. She's got the bod of a Playboy bunny and the brain, roughly speaking, of a lawn sprinkler. At first, no one sees them but Mr. Bachlin, and Mr. Bachlin doesn't seem to realize what he's looking at because he goes right on talking. So, what we need to do, folks, is divide up into a number of teams. Let's say three couples to each team, and we... Mr. Bachlin slows like one of those toys you need to wind up, and then just stands there in front of the Cavell's TV, staring. There's a nervous rustle among the hastily assembled parents who don't understand what can be wrong with him. He was going along so confidently. Josie, he says in a flat, uninflected voice, utterly unlike his usual confident courthouse boom. Yes, says Hector Rinkenhauer. That's her name. What's up, Dave? Are you all right? Josie, Dave says again, and raises a trembling hand. To Henry, and hence to Owen, who is seeing this through Henry's eyes, he looks like the ghost of Christmas yet to come, pointing at Ebenezer Scrooge's grave. One face turns, two, four. Alfie Cavell's eyes, huge and unbelieving, behind his specs. And finally, Mrs. Rinkenhauer's. Hi, Mom, Josie says nonchalantly. She holds up her purse. Daddy found my Barbie can. I was stuck in a... The rest is blotted out by the woman's shriek of joy. Henry has never heard such a cry in his life, and although it is wonderful, it is also somehow terrible. Fuck me, Freddy, Beaver says low under his breath. Jonesy is holding Duddits, who has been frightened by the scream. Pete looks at Henry and gives a little nod. We did okay. And Henry nods back. Yeah, we did. It may not have been their finest hour, but surely... it is a close second. And as Mrs. Rinkenhauer sweeps her daughter into her arms, now sobbing, Henry taps Duddits on the arm. When Duddits turns to look at him, Henry kisses him softly on the cheek. Good old Duddits, Henry thinks. Good old... This is it, Owen, Henry said quietly. Exit 27. Owen's vision of the Cavell living room popped like a soap bubble, and he looked at the looming sign, Keep right for exit 27, Kansas Street. He could still hear the woman's happy, unbelieving cries echoing in his ears. You okay? Henry asked. Yeah. At least I guess so. He turned up the exit ramp, the Humvee shouldering its way through the snow. The clock built into the dashboard had gone as dead as Henry's wristwatch, but he thought he could see the faintest lightning in the air. Right or left at the top of the ramp? Tell me now, because I don't want to risk stopping. Left, left. Owen swung the Hummer left under a dancing blinker light, rode it through another skid, and then moved south on Kansas Street. It had been plowed, and not that long ago, but was drifting in again already. Snow's letting up, Henry said. Yeah, but the wind's a bitch. You're looking forward to seeing him, aren't you, Duddits? Henry grinned. A little nervous about it, but yeah. He shook his head. Duddits, man. Duddits just makes you feel good. He's a tribble. You'll see for yourself. I just wish we weren't busting in like this at the crack of dawn. Owen shrugged. Can't do anything about it, the jester said. They've been over here on the west side for 4 years, I guess, and I've never even been to the new place. And, without even realizing, went on in mind speak. They moved after Alfie died. Did you? And then, instead of words, a picture. People in black under black umbrellas, a graveyard in the rain, a coffin on trestles with R.I.P. Alfie carved on top. No, Henry said, feeling ashamed. None of us did. Owen sent a wordless query. Why not? But Henry didn't know why they hadn't gone, although a phrase occurred to him. The moving finger writes, and having writ moves on. Duddits had been an important... he guessed the word he actually wanted was vital, part of their childhoods. And once that link was broken, going back would have been painful. Painful was one thing, uselessly painful another. He understood something now. The images he associated with his depression and his growing certainty of suicide, the trickle of milk on his father's chin, Barry Newman hustling his double-wide butt out of the office, had been hiding another, more potent image all along. The dream catcher. Hadn't that been the real source of his despair? The grandiosity of the dream catcher concept, coupled to the banality of the uses to which the concept had been put. Using Duddits to find Josie Rinkenhauer had been like discovering quantum physics and then using it to build a video game. Worse, discovering that that was really all quantum physics was good for. Of course, they had done a good thing. Without them, Josie Rinkenhauer would have died in that pipe like a rat in a rain barrel. But come on, it wasn't as if they'd rescued a future Nobel Peace Prize winner. I can't follow everything that just went through your head, Owen said, suddenly deep in Henry's mind. But it sounds pretty goddamn arrogant. Which street? Stung, Henry glared at him. We haven't been back to see him lately, okay? Could we just leave it at that? Yes, Owen said. But we all sent him Christmas cards, okay? Every year, which is how I know they moved to Dearborn Street. 41 Dearborn Street, West Side Dairy. Make your right three streets up. Okay, calm down. Fuck your mother and die. Henry. We just fell out of touch. It happens. Probably never happened to a Mr. Perfection like Your Honor itself, but to the rest of us. The rest of us. Henry looked down, saw that his fists were clenched and forced them to roll open. Okay, I said. Probably Mr. Perfection stays in touch with all his junior high school friends, right? You guys probably get together once a year to snap bras, play your Motley Crue records, and eat tuna surprise just like they used to serve in the cafeteria. I'm sorry if I upset you. Oh, bite me. You act like we fucking abandoned him. Which, of course, was pretty much what they had done. Owen said nothing. He was squinting through the swirling snow, looking for the Dearborn Street sign in the pallid gray light of early morning, and there it was, just up ahead. A plow passing along Kansas Street had plugged the end of Dearborn, but Owen thought the Humvee could beat its way past. It's not like I stopped thinking about him, Henry said. He started to continue by thought, then switched back to words again. Thinking about Duddits was too revealing. We all thought about him. In fact, Jonesy and I were going to see him this spring. Then Jonesy had his accident, and I forgot all about it. Is that so surprising? Not at all, Owen said mildly. He swung the wheel hard to the right, flicked it back the other way to control the skid, then floored the accelerator. The Hummer hit the packed and crusty wall of snow hard enough to throw both of them forward against their seat belts. Then they were through, Owen jockeying the wheel to keep from hitting the drifted-in cars parked on either side of the street. I don't need a guilt trip from someone who was planning to barbecue a few hundred civilians, Henry grumbled. Owen stamped on the brake with both feet, throwing them forward into their harnesses again, this time hard enough to lock them. The Humvee skidded to a diagonal stop in the street. Shut the fuck up! Don't be talking shit you don't understand! I'm likely going to be a dead man because of you, so why don't you just keep all your fucking self-indulgent picture of a spoiled-looking kid with his lower lip sticking out, rationalizing bullshit to yourself. Henry stared at him, shocked and stunned. When was the last time someone had talked to him that way? The answer was probably never. I only care about one thing, Owen said. His face was pale and strained and exhausted. I want to find your typhoid Jonesy and stop him, all right? Fuck your precious tender feelings. Fuck how tired you are, and fuck you. I'm here. All right, Henry said. I don't need any lessons in morality from a guy planning to blow his overeducated, self-indulgent brains out. Okay. So fuck your mother and die. Silence inside the Humvee. Nothing from outside but the monotonous vacuum cleaner shriek of the wind. At last, Henry said, here's what we'll do. I'll fuck your mother, then die. You fuck my mother, then die. At least we'll avoid the incest taboo. Owen began to smile. Henry smiled back. What are Jonesy and Mr. Gray doing? Owen asked Henry. Can you tell? Henry licked at his lips. The itching in his leg had largely stopped, but his tongue tasted like an old piece of shag rug. No, they're cut off. Gray's responsible for that, probably. And your fearless leader, Kurtz? He's getting closer, isn't he? Yeah, if we're going to maintain any kind of lead on him at all, we better make this quick.
Then we will.
Owen scratched the red stuff on the side of his face, looked at the bits of red that came off on his fingers, then got moving again. Number 41, you said? Yeah. Owen? What? I'm scared. Of Duddits? Sort of, yeah. Why?
I don't know.
Henry looked at Owen bleakly.
I feel like there's something wrong with him.
It was her after-midnight fantasy made real, and when the knock came at the door, Roberta was unable to get up. Her legs felt like water. The night was gone, but it had been replaced by a pallid, creepy morning light that wasn't much better, and they were out there. Pete and Beeve, the dead ones, had come for her son. The fist fell again, booming, rattling the pictures on the walls. One of them was a framed front page of the Derry News, the photo showing Duddits, his friends, and Josie Rinkenhauer, all of them with their arms around each other, all of them grinning like mad. How well Duddits had looked in that picture, how strong and normal. Below a headline reading, High School Chums Play Detective, Find Missing Girl. Wham! 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 No, she thought. I'll just sit here, and eventually they'll go away. They'll have to go away, because with dead people, you have to invite them in. And if I just sit tight... But then Duddits was running past her rocker. Running, when these days just walking wore him out, and his eyes were full of their old blazing brightness. Such good boys they had been, and such happiness they had brought him, but now they were dead. They had come to him through the storm, and they were dead. "Duddy, no!" she screamed. But he paid her no attention. He rushed past that old framed picture. Duddits Cavell on the front page. Duddits Cavell, a hero, would wonders never cease. And she heard what he was shouting just as he opened the door on the dying storm.
Annie!
Henry opened his mouth. To say what, he never knew, because nothing came out. He was thunderstruck, dumbstruck. This wasn't Duddits. Couldn't be. It was some sickly uncle or older brother, pale and apparently bald beneath his pushed-back Red Sox cap. There was stubble on his cheeks, crusts of blood around his nostrils, and deep, dark circles beneath his eyes. And yet...
Annie!
The tall, pale stranger in the doorway threw himself into Henry's arms with all of Duddy's old extravagance, knocking him backward on the snowy step, not by force of his weight, he was as light as milkweed fluff, but simply because Henry was unprepared for the assault. If Owen hadn't steadied him, he and Duddits would have gone tumbling into the snow.
Annie!
Laughing, crying, covering him with those big old Duddits smackaroos. Deep in the storehouse of his memory, Beaver Clarendon whispered, "If you guys tell anybody he did that," and Jonesy, yeah, you'll never chum him with us again, you fucking wank. It was Duddits, all right, kissing Henry's virus-speckled cheeks. But the pallor on Duddits's cheeks, what was that? He was so thin. No, beyond thin, gaunt. And what was that? The blood in his nostrils, the smell drifting off his skin. Not the smell that had been coming from Becky's shoe, not the smell of the overgrown cabin, but a deathly smell just the same. And here was Roberta, standing in the hall beside a photograph of Duddits and Alfie at the Derry Days Carnival, riding the carousel, dwarfing their wild-eyed plastic horses and laughing. Didn't go to Alfie's funeral, but sent a card, Henry thought, and loathed himself. She was wringing her hands together, her eyes full of tears, and although she had put on weight at breast and hip, although her hair was now almost entirely gray, it was her. She was still she. But Duddits. Oh, boy. Duddits. Henry looked at her, his arms wrapped around the old friend who was still crying his name. He patted at Duddits's shoulder blade. It felt insubstantial beneath his palm, as fragile as the bone in a bird's wing. "Roberta," he said. "Roberta, my God! What's wrong with him?" "A-L-L," she said, and managed a wan smile. "Sounds like a laundry detergent, doesn't it? It stands for acute lymphocytic leukemia. He was diagnosed 9 months ago, and by then curing him was no longer an option. All we've been doing since then is fighting the clock." "Annie!" Duddits exclaimed. The old, goofy smile illuminated his gray and tired face.
"A-y-if-a-n-y-ay."
"That's right," Henry said, and began to cry. "Same shit, different day."
"I know why you're here," she said, "but don't. Please, Henry, I'm begging you, don't take my boy away from me. He's dying."
Kurtz was about to ask Perlmutter for an update on Underhill and his new friend. Henry was the new friend's name, Henry Devlin. When Pearly let out a long, ululating scream, his face turned up to the roof of the Humvee. Kurtz had helped a woman have a baby in Nicaragua, and they always call us the bad guys, he thought sentimentally. And this scream reminded him of hers, heard on the shores of the beautiful La Juvena River. "Hold on, Pearly," Kurtz cried. "Hold on, Buck. Deep breaths now."
"Fuck you," Pearly screamed. "Look what you got me into, you dirty cunt. Fuck you."
Kurtz did not hold this against him. Women said terrible things in childbirth, and while Pearly was definitely one of the fellas, Kurtz had an idea that he was going through something as close to childbirth as any man had ever experienced. He knew it might be wise to put Perlmutter out of his misery.
"You better not," Pearly groaned.
Tears of pain were rolling down his red-bearded cheeks.
"You better not, you lizard-skin old fuck!"
"Don't you worry, laddie," Kurtz soothed and patted Perlmutter's shivering shoulder. From ahead of them came the steady clanking rumble of the plow Kurtz had persuaded to break trail for them. As gray light began to creep back into the world, their speed had risen to a giddy 35 miles an hour. The plow's taillights glowed like dirty red stars. Kurtz leaned forward, looking at Perlmutter with bright-eyed interest. It was very cold in the back seat of the Humvee because of the broken window, but for the moment, Kurtz didn't notice this. The front of Pearly's coat was swelling outward like a balloon, and Kurtz once more drew his 9mm. "Boss, if he pops..." Before Freddy could finish, Perlmutter produced a deafening fart. The stench was immediate and enormous, but Pearly appeared not to notice. His head lolled back against the seat, his eyes half-lidded, his expression one of sublime relief. "Oh, my fucking grandmother!" Freddy cried, and cranked his window all the way down despite the draft already coursing through the vehicle. Fascinated, Kurtz watched Perlmutter's distended belly deflate. Not yet, then. Not yet, and probably just as well. It was possible that the thing growing inside Perlmutter's works might come in handy. Not likely, but possible. "All things serve the Lord," said the scripture, and that might include the shit weasels. "Hold on, soldier," Kurtz said, patting Pearly's shoulder with one hand and putting the 9 on the seat beside him with the other. "You just hold on and think about the Lord."
"Fuck the Lord," Perlmutter said sullenly,
and Kurtz was mildly amazed. He would never have dreamed Perlmutter could have so much profanity in him. Ahead of them, the plow's taillights flashed bright and pulled over to the right side of the road. "Uh-oh," Kurtz said. "What should I do, boss?" "Pull right in behind him," Kurtz said. He spoke cheerfully, but picked the 9mm up off the seat again. "We'll see what our new friend wants," although he believed he knew.
Freddy, what do you hear from our old friends? Are you picking them up?
Very reluctantly, Freddy said,
only Owen, not the guy with him or the guys they're chasing. Owen's off the road, in a house, talking with someone.
A house in Derry?
Yeah.
And here came the plow driver, striding through the snow in great green gun-rubber boots and a hooded parka fit for an Eskimo. Wrapped around the lower part of his face was a vast woolen muffler, its ends flying up behind him in the wind, and Kurtz didn't have to be telepathic to know the man's wife or mother had made it for him. The plowman leaned in the window and wrinkled his nose at the lingering aroma of sulfur and ethyl alcohol. He looked doubtfully at Freddy, at the only half-conscious Perlmutter, then at Kurtz in the back seat, who was leaning forward and looking at him with bright-eyed interest. Kurtz thought it prudent to hold his weapon beneath his left knee, at least for the time being.
"Yes, Captain?"
Kurtz asked.
"I've had a radio message from a fella says his name is Randall."
The plowman raised his voice to be heard over the wind. His accent was pure down-east Yankee.
"General Randall. Claimed to be talking to me by satellite relay straight from Cheyenne Mountain in Wyoming."
"Name means nothing to me, Cap,"
Kurtz said in the same bright tone, absolutely ignoring Perlmutter, who groaned,
"You lie, you lie, you lie."
The plow driver's eyes flicked to him, then returned to Kurtz.
"Fella gave me a code phrase. Blue exit. Mean anything to you?"
"The name is Bond, James Bond," Kurtz said and laughed. "Someone's pulling your leg, Cap.
Said to tell you that your part of the mission's over and your country thanks you."
"Did they mention anything about a gold watch, laddie buck?"
Kurtz asked, eyes sparkling. The plowman licked his lips. It was interesting, Kurtz thought. He could see the exact moment the plowman decided he was dealing with a lunatic. The exact moment.
"Don't know nothing about no gold watch. Just wanted to tell you I can't take any further. Not without authorization, that is."
Kurtz produced the 9 from where it had been hiding under his knee and pointed it in the plowman's face.
"Here's your authorization, Buck. All signed and filled in triplicate. Will it suit?"
The plowman looked at the gun with his long Yankee eyes. He did not look particularly afraid.
"Yeah, that looks to be in order."
Kurtz laughed.
"Good man, very good man. Now let's get going. And you want to speed it up a little, God love you? There's someone in Derry I have to..."
Kurtz searched for le mot juste and found it.
"To debrief."
Perlmutter half groaned, half laughed. The plowman glanced at him.
"Don't mind him. He's pregnant," Kurtz said in a confiding tone. "Next thing you know, he'll be yelling for oysters and dill pickles."
"Pregnant,"
the plowman echoed. His voice was perfectly flat.
"Yes, but never mind that. Not your problem. The thing is, Buck..."
Kurtz leaned forward, speaking warmly and confidentially over the barrel of his 9mm.
"This fella I have to catch is in Derry now. I expect he'll be back on the road again before too long. I guess he must know I'm coming for his ass."
"He knows, all right," Freddy Johnson said. He scratched the side of his neck, then dropped his hand into his crotch and scratched there.
"But in the meantime," Kurtz continued, "I think I can make up some ground. Now, do you want to put your elderly ass in gear or what?"
The plowman nodded and went walking back to the cab of his plow. The light was brighter now. "This light very likely belongs to the last day of my life," Kurtz thought with mild wonder. Perlmutter began uttering a low sound of pain. It growled along for a bit, then rose to a scream. Perlmutter clutched his stomach again.
"Jesus," Freddy said. "Look at his gut, boss, rising like a loaf of bread."
"Deep breaths," Kurtz said, and patted Pearlie's shoulder with a benevolent hand. Ahead of them, the plow had begun to move again.
"Deep breaths, laddie. Relax. You just relax and think good thoughts."
40 miles